Hello, and welcome to the IDA podcast series, Best Practices in District Energy. I'm Rob Thornton, President and CEO of the International District Energy Association. This podcast platform is brought to you by with the support of the U.S. Department of Energy, Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, and the Industrial Efficiency and Decarbonization Office. As many of you know, IDA members own and operate district energy systems in cities, on campuses, and communities across North America and around the world. And since our founding in 1909, IDEA has been committed to informing, connecting, and advancing the district energy industry. So, as industries, governments, and citizens look for solutions that can be deployed right now to improve efficiency, enhance resilience, and reduce emissions, on this podcast platform, our aim is to explore those innovations, technologies, and best practices that can accelerate our path to a lower carbon economy. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you enjoy this podcast.
Hello, I'm Henry Johnstone. I'm working with the International District Energy Association in the DOE grant project as as the technical lead. I'm the technical lead of the DOE grant project, mechanical engineer by discipline, and fair amount of experience in design and analysis of district heating and cooling systems around the country. All right. So, hello, everybody. We're here to talk about best practices in district energy. This is going to be a recurring podcast put on by the International District Energy Association, IDEA. IDEA is a kind of an advocate for district energy systems across the world, but many members in United States, North America, and elsewhere, really focusing on advocating for district energy systems, outreach, education, kind of building the industry, a real resource for the industry. IDEA is engaged currently in a partnership project with the Department of Energy, particularly the Industrial Efficiency and Decarbonization Office of the Department of Energy, and doing a project that really focused on verifying, validating performance among 40 different sites across the United States, not only engineering performance, but management and financial aspects of the operation of district heating and cooling systems in municipalities, in airports, in healthcare, and in colleges and universities. From that work, one of our deliverables is to put together a podcast, educational podcast, to kind of highlight some of the best of the best. What are the lessons learned in our couple year endeavor here, and through that process, we decided we'd kind of start off our series here by talking with Michelle Bryant of Austin Energy.
Hi, my name is Michelle Bryan. I'm the plant engineer for the Austin Energy District Cooling System here in the city of Austin.
Austin Energy, recent recipient of the IDEA System of the Year Award. So really, best of the best in terms of their membership, the efficiencies, how they manage their business, and the innovation they've been able to apply of late to really become a leader in district cooling of a large municipality. So I'll start here with Michelle. Talk a little about Austin Energy and how you applied for System of the Year.
So we've been, our system started in 1999, and with just one plant and three customers, and we have grown that all the way to 60 customers in downtown and four chilled water plants. We have 7.5 miles of underground piping. It's direct buried, so once we bury it, it's there, it's done. And in our four plants, we have them scattered around downtown so that we have good hydraulics interactions between the different plants. We do a little bit of different things in downtown. We use ice thermal storage, and we have 76,000 ton hours of ice. And that allows us to load shed during the peak thermal energy or the electrical high demand hours of the day during the summer. And then we also do a little bit of difference in trying to do electrical conservation with our chillers as we run 36 degree water in our downtown systems rather than, the normal 40, 42 degree water that typical district cooling systems you do. And that helps our efficiency of our pumps. And yes, we do keep a little hit on our chillers, electrical wise and, electrical consumption wise, but our pumping electricity goes way down, and we can actually size our pumps a little bit better for that efficiency. We go
So
ahead.
Michelle, the ice storage basically in at night and at times when the grid electricity demand isn't real high, you're actually making a huge block of ice or a whole tank full of ice water that you later melt to cool the downtown of Austin. Is that right?
In fact, I call it a big slushy, one of those sonic slushies. So it's not really ice. It's like a really, really cold slushy water. And so what we do is during that 3 to 6 p.m., we turn all our water chillers off and we run all of our warm water through that ice tank. And it goes to our customers out of that ice tank at 36 degree water, sometimes 32. And then at nighttime, around 8 p.m., 9 p.m. at night, we turn on our ice chillers and we cool down that ice tank back down to get ice or slushy. And we use those nighttime where, a lot of power facilities want people to use the power so that they can keep those turbines running in the nighttime so they don't have to turn them off. So we kind of help the grid at night, keeping sustained, so that when the next morning comes, we can, they don't have to turn back their turbines back on. They've already got them already on and ready to go for the next morning.
And this is the alternative of all of your buildings, the 60 buildings or so, each of which has its own little cooling plant, and each of those cooling plants would be running wide open in the afternoon, when with your alternative here, they're really running, there's very little power consumption on the peak periods.
That is correct. So, of the 60 buildings, if you could imagine all 60 buildings running full tilt in that 3 to 6 window, that's a lot of electricity, a lot of water consumption, a lot of power that using us, they don't have to do. And that helps the grid as a whole in the state of Texas, as well as Austin Energy, who supplies, the power downtown. So, it really does help, environmentally wise, water wise, and electrically wise.
And you're actually a part of the local electric utility, or is that more of an arm's length kind of a thing?
We are, our parent is, we're up underneath Austin Energy, who is up underneath the city of Austin. So the city of Austin and the city council dictate goals and requirements from up for us. And then we, in turn, get our directive from Austin Energy, and we are a part of Austin Energy. We're just another, division within Austin Energy who supplies all the electrical power to the customers in Austin.
So was this this you said was started in 1999 or 2000. So 25 years later, do you have big plans to keep on growing, or is this kind of the you're maxed out now?
So we have plans to keep on growing. We are looking into designing another plant inside the new convention center. So we'll have a plant inside, which will be another 10,000 ton plant that will provide cooling to the new convention center when it comes up in 2029. And then we also have quite a bit of more growth in downtown with new buildings coming online. And we are actually going to be providing chilled water to the new 75-story building in downtown, which will be the largest story building in downtown here in 2025.
So the Austin Energy District Cooling System is really a kind of an integral part of the overall development of the downtown as a whole.
Absolutely. A lot of developers reach out to us and say, hey, we're looking for chilled water. We're looking for to be on the grid so that we can get LEED certified. So a lot of buildings want to use our water so they can get those points on LEED certification so that they can say, hey, we're doing this so that we can be more sustainable, more reliable, and more efficient in
Yeah.
downtown.
And I'm guessing you must be more cost effective in some measure.
Absolutely. Definitely, we're more efficient. Our KW per ton is really low, comparative speaking, when you compare it to all the electricity that a building plant would have to use. And we're in a central location. You don't have, different little pieces, little pods all around downtown, and we keep, everything centralized. We conserve our water, we conserve electricity, and we try to be a, minimal footprint, in a carbon emissions realm as well.
Yeah, and that part seems like to me an important aspect of you're a focused operation on cooling. So you're able to do things that other cooling systems wouldn't even try to do. One of the things in your System of the Year award application was your water conservation. So the amount of water you're using in your cooling towers seems to be much better than a typical building cooling tower. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, so in three of our four plants, we use sulfuric acid. So we utilize sulfuric acid so that we can go from about seven cycles of concentration, which is kind of the ratio between your makeup water to your wastewater, what we discharge. So the higher your cycles of concentration, the better your water conservation. So a typical building, cycles of concentration is about three to four cycles of concentration, and we are at seven to our best plant is at 17. So in our first plant, we use water softeners, and the water softeners allow us to cycle up our tower. So we use less wastewater and we, discharge less. So we use water softeners, which allow us to cycle up to 17 cycles of concentration, which is a huge water conservation project that we did. And we use a little bit more chemical in our in our inhibitor, keep our scale from going on in our cooling towers. But we that is a just a small consequence to the overall conservation of water. And then our two of our plants, we use the sulfuric acid, which allows us to cycle up to about 12 cycles of concentration so that we're using a lower pH in our towers and allows us to use water. Our water vendor has been working side by side trying to increase it. He was like going, well, I don't know. Let's see if we can do it. And I said, chemically wise, chemical wise, water wise, I have a chemical engineering degree. And I'm like, we can do this. And so step by step, slowly but slowly, we have worked at getting, from those three to four cycles of concentration to those 12 to 17. And then our last plant is our seven cycle, which is a solids chemistry. And that's the best we can do is seven with those solids chemistry.
Yeah, and as we looked at those the 40 sites, we never found anyone that was even close to doing what you're doing. And I think of Austin as having fairly hard water. Isn't that true? There's a lot of limestone.
That is a lot of limestone. So what this city water does is they cold lime soften the water. So
Okay.
they actually pre-soften the water to get that hardness out. So that's how we're able to help in getting that those cycles up due to our hard water that exists, naturally in our water system.
Yeah. But the real advantage of being a district energy system as opposed to individual buildings is you've got the level of expertise that, a degree in chemical engineering and the focus, the mission to say, let's really do this right and make something happen. This would be very difficult to pull off, on a building by building basis.
That is true. That's what's, the beauty of district cooling is you have the expertise and the knowledge, and you can centralize that and make these, sweeping conservation efforts for a centralized plant. So you don't have to have expertise in every single building. You have a centralized expertise and knowledge base in one company and in one facility.
So other aspects of this, I think in your application there was some conversation about the way you sort of remotely monitor and manage the equipment in various plants and the remote breakers. Can you talk a little about that?
Absolutely. So we have a so we run on a very slim scale. We have eight operators for the 24/7
Wow.
facility. So we have eight operators to do 24/7 work. So we have three in the morning, two in the evening, and two at night. And
Yeah.
then we have one that goes around and in the daytime, and they're more of a daytime operator that kind of goes in and makes sure we have maintenance and taking care of things. So what we do is we have each of the monitors, each plant has its own plant PLC system, their own controllers. They're all redundant. So if one controller fails, another controller will pick up. We have redundant power supply. We have redundant power going into the plant, redundant power going into our critical, controllers, our critical equipment. And so our operators are all use one plant to go in and remotely see everything else. So each plant is tied in with a network of fiber underground. So every one of our pipe has fiber. Conduits with fiber in it so that all of our customers, all of our plants are all tied in to that one network. And so we have multiple fibers. So if one fiber line goes down, we have another spare fiber to attach so that we don't have an issue with getting connectivity to our plants. And so at a central location, all operators can see all plants. So if they're at DCP1, they can see the plant at two, three, and four. Or if they're at four, which is our smallest plant, they can see three, two, and one. And so they can every plant can be operated from every other plant. So, we don't have operators at all the plants. They can see everything. And the plants are programmed such that the plant can actually operate on its own. It doesn't need an operator. Once it has its commands to operate, it will go and operate it by itself. Now the operators do have to turn on a water chiller, but that's all they've got to do. They have one button says turn on water chiller, and the controls will actually open the valves, turn on the pumps, turn on the fans, turn on the pumps, turn on the distribution pumps, and do everything by one click of a button. And so the so it makes it really easy for the operators to kind of operate and then go do maintenance, because our operators are not just operators, they're maintenance as well. So they'll be out of the control room. And what we have is we have our alarms go to their cell phones. So we have an operator's cell phone. And so all the alarms go to those cell phones. And so if there's an alarm, they'll get it on their cell phone and they will know, oh, okay, I need to go to the control room to go check on a piece of equipment. Maybe something's tripped, or maybe they've got a flow alarm saying, hey, you need to turn on another chiller, or hey, this chiller is unloading. Maybe you need to turn off a chiller. So that's the remote operations for the facilities. But we also have remote racking in and out of our switchgear. So it's, the operators have to actually be on site to actually rack out the equipment, but they can plug in via an Ethernet cable, walk the distance probably about 20 feet from the gear, and then with a little controller, actually go in and rack out our 12/4/7 switchgear breakers. So that's really awesome. They don't have to be in a suit. They don't have to be suited up. There's no protective that they have to do. They can actually be really well away from the arc flash zone and not be in danger. Also, actually from the from any plant, they can actually press a button and open and close a breaker. If it's already racked in and energized, they can go from the control room and rack in, not rack in, but open or close any breaker on the gear. And so that's something that's really nice, so that if there's any issue, they can open up that breaker and then go to that breaker in a safe environment with it already off and open and ready to be looked at.
So that's a major safety, a very sophisticated way of handling a potentially high risk kind of an operation. So
Yes.
that's something I can imagine a lot of other kinds of systems like this could really benefit from.
Absolutely.
I'm amazed at the staff. You said was it eight people altogether? That's what who runs it on a day-to-day basis.
Yes, 8 people.
So if you compared that to what it would take if you had 60 individual buildings, that's definitely some labor savings here. And it sounds like it's a
Absolutely.
combination of labor savings and very intelligent design and fairly sophisticated control algorithms and safety functions.
Absolutely. We not only, safety is, our number one priority. Safety starts with me, the individual. It's not the company's, even though the company says safety starts. And we are, that's one of our strategic goals, is to work in a safe manner and make sure it's safe for everyone. It's a inherent for each individual that if you see something, say something. That is our edict. If you see something unsafe, say something. Don't just ignore it. If you see a cable in the way, make sure to remove it. If it's an extension cord, that's a tripping hazard. Don't like someone else do it. Go take it upon yourself to remove the safety hazard. And so, it's really paramount that we put that, safety comes first in all things, not just in people safety, but environmental safety, electrical safety, making sure that, our customers are safe, making sure that the pedestrians that go in and tour our plants, the people are all safe as we, give tours, as we give, knowledge is power. And if you have safety as part of that knowledge, is really, key to making a facility work at its best.
That's a good way to say that. Could we talk a little about your customer interface? And how do you manage all of these individual building owners and developers and keep everybody happy? How hard is that?
You know, some days it's a challenge, but it's all worth it. We start very early with the customers, at the very inception of, hey, a building wants to build, a builder wants to come and build a building in downtown. We have staff that go in and go and do outreach and say, hey, you want to connect to our system? Here are your benefits. Here's your cost structure. And if they say, yes, we want to, then we start with here's what we need. And so what we have created is a what's called a customer connection requirement. We call them CCRs for short. And so this gives them an outline of what we require from you, what you require from us, and what we need to make sure that our partnership is fluid, it is transparent, and that we work well together, because the last thing we want is a misunderstanding between the developer who wants to use Chillwater and us who are providing the Chillwater. So we work together seamlessly from the very beginning all the way until we start providing Chillwater. And so each of our customer interfaces, we say we want a dedicated room. Here's the size of the room that we would like. And then we actually design skids. We have a skid manufacturer that has all of our requirements. And so we use heat exchangers, and our heat exchanger design like 50-50. So 50% in one heat exchanger, 50% in the other. And these two heat exchangers run side by side at all times, even in low load conditions and in the maximum load conditions. Our heat exchangers are run simultaneously. We don't turn off a heat exchanger during low load conditions and turn on and utilize two at this with high load. We use both of them at the same time. And so we say, here's the room. Here's what we need. Here's what we'll provide you. Here is a temperature profile that we expect of you. And so we expect our customers to give us a 15 degree delta on their side. And that allows us to get a 14 degree delta on our side of the heat exchangers. And so by requiring that 15 degree delta on their side, it makes our plants more efficient and allow us to provide more cooling with the plant structure and equipment that we have.
How challenging is that for the building operators and to maintain 50? Are there issues that keep them from prevent them from getting that kind of a temperature split?
That is a high temperature split, so that's all we try to get with the engineers while they're building and designing that plant. So we want to try to get those building developers as soon as they start so that we can get in the design those 15 degree fan cool units that they're going to use, or their air handling units that they're going to use, so that there is no impact. Because if you design it with 12 and we have a contract for 15, they're never going to get that. And so we actually require them to have that 15 degrees. And so our control valve will require them to give us that 15 degree delta. So even if their supply temperature requirement is 44 degrees, if they're not giving us 59, we'll start pinching back on the flow to make sure that they give us the 59 degrees so that we're always, efficient on our side. And so we also have reports that we use for approach, our heat exchanger approach. So if we start seeing that heat exchanger approach get past its design, then we need to know, oh, we need to go clean that heat exchanger. We need to go figure out what's going on with those heat exchangers and making sure that those heat exchangers are kept within the design parameters.
So you take responsibility for maintaining the heat exchangers, or is that kind of a 50-50 split with the
No, we own those heat exchangers. So the customer does not touch those heat exchangers. So anything on the skid, is ours to maintain. So we maintain them, we keep them cleaned, and we make sure that they are running optimally. It's
Yeah.
all on Austin Energy.
In practice, is this temperature split issue an ongoing problem, or is it occasional anomalies, or is it like an ongoing battle?
So with our older customers, because we've evolved so much, our old customers, it is a little bit more of a challenge. As we work with them, we find that the use of three-way valves are really problematic. And in those earlier constructive buildings, they use those three-way valves. So we say, hey, close those three-way valves, make them just two-way valves. And hey, do you have any bypasses that you might have open? Or, what we have found here recently is that the buildings, like especially our hotels, use our chilled water to cool down their compressors for their water fountains. And so when their water fountains and their ice machines are not being utilized for cooling, then they're running that water straight back in, because your cold water going into your warm water, it's always going to co cool down your warm water. And so they've started working at implementing, hey, if it's not being, if the compressor's not turning on, then we need to shut the valve and not flow water. And they've actually increased their return water temperature. So we work hand in hand. We go in and do a walkthrough through their building to try to figure out how can they make their return water better, temperature wise. And again, it's a partnership between the building and us, and we want to, because we want to make them better for their system, and we want us to be better. So it's, it's a synergistic partnership.
And that really seems like one of the best practices that we picked up from your looking at your system there is this collaboration and this real willingness on your side or mission on your side to improve the customer interface through this kind of let's figure out what the problems are and solve them. So that seemed like a big deal that you take that so seriously.
Yes, we take it very seriously. Without our customers, we wouldn't exist, is how our philosophy is. So we want to make sure our customers are happy, our customers are getting the chilled water they need, and anything that we can to do to help them, it helps us in the long run.
So let's move on a little to kind of the overall benefit proposition for your system in Austin. Maybe just talk a little about, well, I mean you led into this, the benefits to the local and regional electric grid, the Texas grid. How operating your system coordinates and improves the overall system operation.
Yeah, so we have we do our shifting from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., which is in Austin in the summertime, the highest peak load time periods of the day. That's where people are getting home from school or from work. They're turning their air conditioners on because they want their house to be nice and cool when they get home. They want to be in a cool environment. They're turning on their TVs. They're cooking supper. They're doing everything in that 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Time frame. And so our plants combined, when we actually go in and turn off our plants, we actually reduce it by about 16 megawatts of power. So if you can imagine 16 megawatts of power off the grid in 15 minutes, for a three and a half hour period of time, that's a substantial benefit to the electrical grid when it is in those really tough times to get this Also, you know, what we haven't started, but we're working on doing is being on an emergency responsive reserve. We're working at trying to be able to do that as well. So in other times where there is a, you know, high demand of electricity, they can give us a call and we can shed our load. We haven't gotten to that point yet, but we're working on getting that as well, so that we can shift at different times of the day when, you know, the electrical demand is so high. You know, we leverage those ice tanks so that we can be a benefit to the electrical grid. And how we benefit Austin Energy is, you know, that 16 megawatts Austin Energy doesn't have to buy from ERCOT, you know, because Austin Energy, you know, buys all their power from ERCOT. Even though we generate power to ERCOT, and then we buy back that power from ERCOT. So, you know, they don't have to, you know, buy 16 megawatts of power, and it can get all the way up to $5,000 a megawatt. And so it makes it really beneficial for Austin Energy, and in turn, the customers, because the customers, the electrical customers of Austin Energy, because we've saved them in those high time periods, you know, that savings gets back to the customer.
And when you say get back to the customer, that's not just your customers in downtown. That's system wide. It's everybody's benefiting from your behavior downtown.
Absolutely. Every person that has a power bill for Austin Energy is affected by us shifting that load in that 3 to 6 window.
That's huge. There's a lot of news, in, you know, around the country about the ERCOT grid this summer when there was a long stretch of really hot days. Would you have been able to help that if you had this new program in place?
So we did, actually. They called on, we get emails, even though we're not on the emergency responsive reserve. They sent out an email wide saying, hey, can you reduce your load? So that's what we did. We turned off our chillers and reduced our load, even though we weren't in that emergency response reserve program. We still turned off our chillers, and we pulled it down, you know, 2 more megawatts of what we did. We couldn't turn off all of our chillers because it was right after our 3 to 6 window, but we were able to turn off 2 more megawatts of power that we weren't using.
So it's working now. That's pretty cool. How about benefits to the city? What would you say, you know, your operation, your plans, how does that benefit the city of Austin?
So, you know, we have the conservation goals from the city. So the city gives us, you know, they want, you know, they have environmental goals for the city. They have their strategic plan, their strategic goals. And we are a part of achieving those goals for the city. So, you know, for the, you know, economics, for, you know, the, you know, the footprint of emissions that we're utilizing, and, you know, the benefit of, you know, the citizens. You know, you don't have cooling towers and puffs of, you know, plumes all over the downtown, and it makes it for a nice, prettier downtown. You know, you don't have more of that smoggy look of all those cooling towers, you know, producing all that plume up in the air. So it makes it for a prettier skyline.
Sure. Yeah. And are there city buildings on your system? Are there city operations as well?
Yes. So we have City Hall. So all city council is in City Hall. And so, and then the city lawyers. So we want to make sure that we keep the City Hall all nice and happy and cool. We have the convention centers. That is a city facility that we provide cooling to. And we also provide cooling to the city main library in downtown.
And I assume the city has some kind of a sustainability plan or goal, and you're probably a key part of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they do.
How about developers? Do you have trouble selling developers on connecting to your system versus building their own, or Do they just flock to you?
It's a 50-50. We have developers that they want to be in charge of everything, and no matter how beneficial it is, we can't convince them. They're just like, no, we want everything all together, and we don't want to use your system. But it really is beneficial because they don't have the chiller equipment that they have to maintain, the maintenance people to maintain those chillers. They don't have to have the contracts for the chiller manufacturer to maintain those chillers and cooling towers. Now they can have the green space on top of their buildings rather than having cooling towers on top of their buildings. But some building owners are just like really staunch. And it starts with building developers, but also building engineers. We have a lot of building engineers that are proponents of district cooling and say, hey, let's get you on district cooling. You only have one little mechanical room and some pumps, and that's it for your chiller system. And we're 100% reliable, so you have cooling all the time. You don't have to worry about a chiller tripping or a chiller not making load or a chiller, because even if you're using a lot more load than you normally would, our system will provide you that load all the way up to your maximum design, which is normally a lot more than what their typical maximum is in a building.
Sure. So, the value proposition for developers is there. They can look at this thing and say, it may make more sense for us. We have some benefits up front. We don't have to build our own chiller plant. There's going to be some kind of a connection fee, but that's worth it when you look at the long term.
Absolutely, yes.
And if you were just to think about what the benefits to the final occupants, the people who are either leasing or owning the spaces, what would they say? Is this, why would they want to?
So we have one building that had their own chillers, and people that were in there were always complaining that it was too hot. They were always getting hot calls. And so their chillers were getting to their end of life, and so they decided to connect up to the district cooling in downtown system, and they never had a hot call afterwards.
I'll be darned.
So they're like going, oh my goodness, it was like a difference between night and day. We would always have these. In the warmer portions of the day, we'd get warm, or it'd be a sticky feeling. But now it's cool, 24/7. We don't have those hot calls anymore. So, the livable environment and the working environment is pretty much constant throughout the entire day. There is no, oh my goodness, the chiller is at maximum and it's doing everything it can. It's the same temperature every single day, every single hour.
Oh, and that sounds very, very significant. So you're ultimately the recipient of hot calls. You're now the somewhat
Yes,
responsibility.
absolutely.
And I imagine when you have record strings of record heat, it becomes more and more important from a from a health and safety standpoint that the air conditioning works in these facilities. And I think what you're saying is, compared to standalone, you really have a better setup for reliability and resiliency against these kind of temperature extremes.
Absolutely. We had here in Austin 12 straight days of over 105 degree temperature, not one hot call.
Whoa, that's a, yeah. That is something to be proud of. That's pretty cool. So talk a little about the value chain, just the overall, how all of this stuff kind of relates among itself.
We get our environmental goals, our electrical demand management goals, our economic development goals from city council, because again, we are a city-owned business. So city council gives us these economic goals. They give us these electrical demand goals. They give us these economic goals to Austin Energy. And Austin Energy, with this bonding capability, with this ability to go out and get money from financial houses through credit, gives us money at District Energy and Cooling to build plants, to maintain our plants, to make sure that we can provide chilled water to our ultimate chilled water customers. So we provide a lower capital cost for our customers and also a lower life cycle cost to them, you know, because all that is a heat exchanger. Those heat exchangers have a 50-year lifespan. No, there's nothing other than their pumps and these heat exchangers that, you know, every once in a while we have to clean. But other than that, they're a very long-term equipment cost, and so very low life cycle cost for these facilities. In turn, the facilities, the buildings provide district energy and cooling our revenue, so our money stream. And from that, we return that capital to Austin Energy, and it allows Austin Energy to have a diversified portfolio of revenue. And from that, we also are providing the goals to city council, those environmental goals, those economic, those electrical goals, and making sure that we're, you know, shifting power. Our goal is to make, you know, make sure that we're shifting as a district wide, you know, 20 megawatts. Right now, downtown alone is doing 16, but we also have three other facilities load shedding as well. And then, you know, that allows those goals to be met. And then city council can go back to its constituents and say, look, here's what we're doing for you, Austin Energy, and not Austin, you Austin people, the people of Austin, here's what we're doing. Citizens, here's what the city is doing for you as it relates to economics, as it relates to environmental, as it relates to electricity and those electrical goals.
So this is really a successful business model as a whole. You're able to generate not only revenue but goodwill and political success. That's pretty
Absolutely.
incredible. I'm always been surprised that other municipalities haven't kind of taken this model themselves. What would you say the big obstacles could be for others to adopt this method?
You know, it's you know, it all deals with money, right? Everything goes down to it costs a lot to make sure to be, you know, reliable, to be environmental stewards. It's we, you know, we're trying to, it's not cheap to get this, and so to have the capital, and you know, and we're blessed that, you know, Austin Energy understands our capital needs. The city understands our capital needs so that we can be reliable, sustainable, you know, good stewards of the environment. We've had lots of facilities reach out to us, and we give tours, you know, in Jacksonville, Florida reached out to us. Jackson, Florida reached out to us. City of San Antonio has reached out to us and saying, hey, what is your model? How can we mimic your model? And so, and we are, you know, we want to provide any information to others. So if there's other facilities who want to tour our system or have a conversation with us, we're open. We're not a closed book. And I think that's the main way to disseminate the information is we're an open book. If you want to know how we do it, come and contact us.
Very, very good. What a great attitude. And yeah, let's hope that others adapt this or something similar, and kind of, you know, further the idea. Well, as we wrap up, I guess I just wanted to, you know, kind of talk about the three aspects of this. I think Austin Energy really demonstrates a lot of innovation and best practices in kind of the engineering and the technology and the, you know, the actual how does this work? How do you put in the infrastructure? The idea that you have this giant slushy machine that's benefiting the overall electric grid is kind of cool. And certainly that could be adapted many places around the world. 25 years of experience doing it this way can't go wrong.
Absolutely. You know, that's something that we engineer everything. So, you know, we look at how can we be more innovative? How can we engineer this? How can we value engineer, not value engineer's cost savings, but how can we value engineer making sure that we're looking at all those environmental requirements that we put on ourselves to make sure that we're good stewards to the world at large.
So it's a part of this success is the sort of the technical side of it, but a large part of it is the operations and management. The fact that you've figured out a way to really optimize labor. So you've got, 8 operators running a huge system with very intelligent support and infrastructure behind it. So can you speak to that? Just the overall focus you must have on efficient operation must be very big.
Yes, it is. So, our operators are highly skilled. So we make sure we train them well. We make sure that they have all of the things that they need. And, the control system will tell them there's alarms to help them know, hey, there's something wrong with this piece of equipment. You need to go look at it. We use Maximo for our work orders so that they know, the maintenance schedule. So, it's a learned way of doing things, and the operators know exactly what's going on, and the engineering staff and the management staff are there to support them. So, it's a it takes a village to run everything. It's not just one operator. It's not just one engineer or one supervisor or one superintendent. It takes everyone to run these plants efficiently and effectively.
A real focused team. And then finally, this just the ability to you talked a little about the capital requirements. And really, maybe it goes back to the vision and the foresight of the city council back in 1998 or whenever the idea first came forward, that somebody was actually able to think far enough ahead to commit the resources, to commit the city into an operation like this. Why can't we have more politicians like that?
Yeah, it definitely was a leap of faith. No one back in 1999 would have visioned that it would have been so big, 20, 23, 25 years later. We start out with this little bitty facility with these little bitty dreams, and it's growing and it's still growing today, as we speak.
Very good. Well, I want to commend Austin Energy for the success they've had and your commitment to sharing your information with others. Hopefully this podcast will reach some of those folks and you'll be getting some calls.
That'd be
And
awesome.
again, thank you. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us for this podcast. We hope you found some information, maybe some contacts and solutions that'll help you in your career and pathway. If you're looking for more information, don't hesitate to visit us at www.districtenergy.org. The International District Energy Association, our 3,000 members worldwide, are happy to be of help. I'm Rob Thornton, and thank you again for joining us.